Steve, you're back.
I am, yeah. I'm all better now. My Boris Johnson allergies have kind of dropped down. My voice has returned. I'm back and I'm ready to go.
Fantastic. Your allergy has dropped. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Boris Johnson allergies, very similar to puberty, obviously.
Yeah, it just comes once and then never comes back again. Yeah.
I should say thank you to Charlie and thank you to David as well for holding the fort. I think did a pretty creditable job being the Night Watchman.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, absolutely.
But you're back, fighting fit.
Yeah, and nothing's wrong at all. And
no.
Oh, what's that on the TV? What's breaking news?
Oh, it's all right. It's so the Tory leadership announcement has come out, Steve. It turns out Boris Johnson's going to be Prime Minister. Oh, listeners, it looks like Steve is screaming into the void. He's opening his mouth, but no words are coming out. It might just have to be me on my own for this one. Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast where nothing is true and everything is possible. My name is Corey Hazelhurst and my partner of propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello, Corey. It is genuinely great to be back.
Well, and the voice has returned as well, miraculously. It's amazing what Dave Depper's theme tune will do for the miraculous...
It's the healing power of plucky good times.
It must... That will probably be Boris Johnson's epitaph, I imagine. So we are recording this Tuesday, 7 o'clock. The plan, all being well, is for this to go out on Wednesday afternoon. So the only appointment I think that's been made to his government so far is the Chief Whip, Mark Spencer.
There's been a few advisors and things announced as well, including some people who work for Murdoch and various bits and pieces like that.
Mark Spencer apparently makes very good pies. So looking forward to that in the event of a no-deal Brexit. So Johnson won, beat Jeremy Hunt, not very much a surprise. Tell you what was a little bit of a surprise, though, Steve, was the margin of victory, because we were having a talk about this in the Not Enough Champagne bunker intercom with a few of our regular contributors and trying to work out what we thought the margin of victory would be. And with my usual soothsaying ability, I said I'd be really surprised if Johnson got below 70%. And he did.
Yeah, he didn't get 70% at all. Yeah, I think there were a couple of us who thought, you know, a 70-30 split was probably what we were looking at. I think I came closest with something like 64-36 or something like that, which was about right. I think I can't remember what the exact figures are off the top of my head.
It's basically bang on 66%. Johnson got 92,000 votes, Hunt got 46,000. So almost literally 2-1. On an 87.4% turnout. Turnout the Tory leadership higher than in the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems, Steve, they claim that they care about political reform.
They can't even be bothered to vote for their own leader.
They talk the talk, Steve. Do they walk the walk? Mark, by the way.
Actually, what I find to be the most interesting fact about this is that more people voted for Owen Smith than Boris Johnson. Bantasaurus Rex, I can contend at this moment in time, based on the raw number of votes, has a bigger mandate than Boris Johnson.
Well, yeah, and we talked about Bantasaurus Rex, our old friend Owen Smith, who spent a leadership campaign joking about the length of his penis, because, as he gave him his full title, the margin of victory, I think, was less. It was less than I supposed, and certainly YouGov, who are generally pretty good at getting membership polls right. I remember they got, I think, Corbyn's victory over Smith bang on, so Corbyn won 62-38 over Bantasaurus Rex. They didn't quite get 2015 Labour leadership bang on, but they predicted, I think, Corbyn to be over 50%, which again was right. I think the YouGov polling said that Johnson was going to get 74-77% of the vote, so it was a little bit less than was expected, really.
Yeah, I mean, although, again, it kind of depends on where you're looking. So whenever you're looking at Tory membership polling and things like that, one of the first places you should look is actually the Conservative Home website, which has got a very good track record of predicting these sorts of contests. And again, was more or less spot on this one as well. So I think, unsurprisingly, the website which has access to a lot more conservative members than YouGov actually will do, it's able to do a better job at polling them. Broadly speaking, YouGov probably did all right. It's not like it was a catastrophe where they were massively out. Actually, well, if they were saying it's about 70% and it was got, what, 66%? Probably margin of error, depending on the sample size you're looking at. So actually, it's not too bad for them on that prediction level.
What the margin says to me, though, is that someone like Michael Gove, I think, would have got much closer than Johnson. I think would have given Johnson a much tougher fight and possibly might have won, or if not quite won, but certainly I think you're looking at more of a 55-45.
Or, vote. You know, that hilarious vote percentages which come up everywhere, the 48-52 split, which I think would have been the perfect outcome for the Conservative leadership election, whoever won it. But I think you are right that actually the results show that Johnson did very well. Don't get me wrong, he does have a mandate from the Conservative Party. And a decent one at that. It's a decent size. It's comparable, but slightly less than David Cameron's. And no one ever claimed that David Cameron didn't have a mandate to lead the Conservatives in the way that he did. So Boris Johnson does have that mandate. But it wasn't a runaway success, when you look at it, because as you say, so much of it was, oh, actually we should be getting 70% or above, and that didn't happen.
Hmm.
So maybe part of that's just poor media management and expectations of management from Boris's campaign towards the tail end of the end of it.
Oh. Look what you've done, Steve. No. Look what you've done. And I've just remembered what I forgot to say. Yes, because we have a rule in the Not Enough Champagne Bunker that if you mention Boris and you don't say Mr. Johnson or Boris Johnson, or dare I say it now, well, not Prime Minister yet, but leader of the Conservative Party, I'm sorry, you're going to have to make a prediction. Boris Johnson has said that a woman, I believe, will be one of the four great officers of state in his cabinet. Which woman do you think it will be? What position do you think they'll hold?
Priti Patel, Home Secretary.
Interesting prediction. Okay. Yes, margin of victory.
But the margin of victory itself then isn't that impressive. As a result, you are probably correct that somebody like Gove or maybe somebody else might have been able to put up more of a fight. Somebody who was viewed as less continuity, Theresa May, I think is fundamentally the issue that Jeremy Hunt had, may have been able to make it a better fight. But this is the result of a political party whose members, broadly speaking, quite like the person they've elected leader, but there's enough of them that don't that it could be problematic for them. And again, actually, I think that holds up when you look at David Cameron as well. Granted, the problem members for the leadership have now kind of reversed. For Cameron, it was obviously the right. For Boris Johnson, it's going to be the left of the party. But it's a similar number of problematic members and problematic MPs who are going to make the new leader's life very, very difficult.
And similar when Corbyn beat Bandasaurus Rex, I believe I'm right in saying there was a majority of Labour members who've been members longer than 2015 voted in favour of Bandasaurus Rex rather than Corbyn, despite the penis references and fighting thousands of Welsh men to get his wife.
Yep.
I thought I'd be experiencing Boris Johnson trauma. I'm going back to Owen Smith trauma. Maybe that feels like a happier place. In a way, maybe it is. On the other hand,
the glory days.
We'll break out into a Springsteen song soon. So this campaign, as you say, not a runaway success. Mirina Hyde, in one of her ever-entertaining columns, does list the, I'm not going to say gaffes, because a gaffe is when you tell the truth and you didn't really mean to tell the truth. But we're going to have a look at things that happened in this leadership campaign for Boris Johnson, which in any other leadership campaign would probably have seen that person get torpedoed. So I'm essentially just going to quote verbatim. So we saw he failed to defend the UK's most senior ambassador against an absurd attack by the US president, had the police called to a late night screaming argument at his girlfriend's flat, was exposed as incapable of understanding basic elements of his own trade plans, claimed like the maddest of all mad bastards to have some wine crate based model bus building hobby, lied repeatedly about everything from the total inviability of his flagship policy to how long he'd owned a bike before it was stolen. Refused 26 times to say when a faux paparazzi picture of him and his girlfriend was staged and taken. Declined to say how many kids he has. Shamelessly suggested he might prorogue Parliament. And waved a kipper around to illustrate a claim that 30 seconds of Googling would have revealed as more complete bollocks. So, that said, do you want to talk about the ones there that matter?
Yeah, I think whenever you talk about kind of like Boris Johnson and his, let's call them media slip-ups for the time being, just because we need to call them something that isn't just me banging my head against the wall.
Willis moments.
Yeah, Willis moments. But yeah, the thing about Johnson's Willis moments is that some of them are really serious. Others don't actually matter. The bus thing with, oh, I like to make wooden buses out of cardboard boxes or crates or whatever it was, and I like to make the little people and put them on happy journeys going through my imaginary London. That doesn't matter. It's a weird little thing which he was clearly lying about. It might have been a deliberate attempt to change what comes up when you Google Boris Johnson and bus, so that you don't get the 350 million on the side of the bus from the referendum or whatever. But it was clearly bollocks. It was clearly a lie. But it doesn't matter.
Do we credit Lyndon Crosby with that much evil genius? And that says on the postcard, but not the champagne bunker.
Exactly. But that doesn't matter. The kipper incident, from my perspective, I don't think matters. Like, yes, it's crap, but it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's like Theresa May and the criminal who couldn't be deported because he'd got a cat story from a few years back. It was crap. It wasn't actually she didn't actually tell the story right or give the full context. But that's nothing new. Politicians not providing the full context for something isn't anything new at all. Like Boris Johnson is still just continuing an age-long tradition in that level. But there are some things which really do matter. The fact that you didn't stand up to defend Kim Darroch against Donald Trump, effectively giving Donald Trump a veto on who our ambassador is, and effectively making sure that in future our ambassadors aren't going to be able to give candid advice to the government for fear that actually, one, that the information could leak, and two, they could then lose their jobs for it. That's massively problematic. Let's talk about the fact that Nazanin Ratcliffe is still in an Iranian jail right now, directly, at least partially, because of Boris Johnson's screw-up as Foreign Secretary. That really matters. Let's talk about the trade plans and the fact that he doesn't understand his own plans at all, because that really matters, given where we are in the world and the fact that we're meant to be leaving the European Union and therefore we need an independent trade policy. Those are the things we should be focusing on, rather than the wooden crate buses and the kipper.
You're absolutely right about Kim Darroch, and we didn't talk about it with any of the night watchmen who were standing in. We are planning a podcast on the civil service over the summer, so we're going to address that in more detail. But you're right, it was a massive story, and I think it's a chilling effect on, as you say, ambassadors and what they report. But it is a massive issue which we can't really understate. I would slightly take issue with saying the kipper doesn't matter and that Theresa May's lie about a cat doesn't matter, because as someone who loves glib, wider political metaphors, I think actually Theresa May's lie about the criminal who can't be deported owning a cat is important, because it tells us about Theresa May that she's very relaxed about saying things that aren't true if she thinks they'll please the grassroots of the Tory party. And that turned out to be quite significant in the months and years in the premiership. Same with Boris Johnson's lie or untruth or whatever you want to call it, that it was EU regulations that mean that kippers have to be wrapped in plastic ice buckets or whatever it was, because it's a nice kind of endpoint. Boris Johnson made his name as a Telegraph correspondent churning out untrue stories about EU regulations. And here he is about to become Prime Minister talking about an untrue story of EU regulation being responsible for something. So it's quite nice in that sense. It's got a wonderful narrative arc. If I have the time to write a blog post, that's definitely the angle I go for. But I think it also says a lot about what Johnson's premiership is going to be like. And he read a lot of, there's a really good Tom Tague long piece on the Atlantic, a few other long pieces as well. And what they often hone in on is Johnson's laziness, his lack of work ethic, his lack of grasp of detail, which goes into the trade plans, and his ability at times not to tell the truth. I mean, he was sacked from the Tory shadow front bench because he didn't tell his party leader the truth about his affairs, for instance. He was sacked from the Times for making up a quote. Not having the facts at hand is his stock in trade. And I think that becomes really important. When you're Prime Minister, it's useful to A, be bothered to work out what the facts are, and B, tell people, tell the British public and your cabinet the facts as they are.
I would contend that there's a difference between Boris Johnson being unable to deal with the facts when challenged, which is the core thing there, I think, is when he's challenged, he does not do well at all. Like we got together with some of our friends to watch one of the Conservative leadership debates that was on the BBC. And when he got challenged, you could see him visibly kind of shrinking back from the questioning, and he did not look comfortable at all in comparison to anybody else on the panel. But I think there's a difference between that and a bit of theatrics to end a speech, which I get where you're coming from with the with the kipper. I can't believe we're saying the word kipper so much on this podcast. This is what Boris Johnson has brought me to.
We're not in relation to UKIP.
I know.
Although we've probably never called them kippers, even when UKIP were a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is apparently one of the reasons he did what he did in his speech, was because kipper sounds like UKIP, which is it's the level of genius we're now dealing with here. That's a theatrical moment. I still don't think it's as important as the actual issues, which is like Nazanin Ratcliffe, like Kim Darroch, like the trade stuff and things like that. It's definitely evidence of what sort of person Boris Johnson is, but we already knew all this. This is not new. This is not news at all. No, as he said, it's quite a nice narrative arc because we already know it.
But I think it tells us what sort of Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to be, I think. And it is one, I mean, Boris, I would argue, and I'm going to argue it because it's the title of the episode, we've not got to there yet, that this is the triumph of postmodern politics. Chris Dillow, who's a really, really good left-to-centre blogger, usually in economics, has written about this. We'll put the links to these in the show notes, but essentially his idea of postmodern politics is that we're in a feature in which appearances are everything and consequences and reality are nothing. So, for instance, some of the examples that he gives is the fact that Brexiters obsess about trade deals when actually these do little to boost trade. The fact that BBC's keen to report splits and gaffes but doesn't do detailed policy analysis. The fact you had Sarah Vine tweeting a few weeks ago saying that, oh, I didn't realise that people with dementia were struggling to claim benefits. Why is this? And again, it's because in terms of rhetoric of Tory policies, the rhetoric of things like universal credit is it's only scroungers who are affected. With hostile environment, it's only illegal immigrants who need to be worried. Whereas actually the reality of those policies is it's not just scroungers who are affected, it's everyone on benefits who's affected. It's vulnerable people who's affected. It's people who are ill are affected. Say with hostile environment, the people who get deported are not just illegal immigrants, they're British citizens who have been here for 30, 40 years. And Johnson's premiership, I think, is, and certainly how he's campaigned, which the kipper thing comes into, but as well as his rhetoric about how he's campaigned, his leadership, it's all about the show and the theatrics rather than the substance. Because, I mean, you're absolutely right, in terms of the Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, Boris Johnson hasn't talked about his time as Foreign Secretary at all that I've seen in those hustings. Jeremy Hunt, oh yes, mentioned he was an entrepreneur, but also had a story to tell about he was Health Secretary, he's put more money into the NHS, he sorted out junior doctor stuff. Now, we know that that's a bunch of wuss, but he's making that case. There isn't even a superficial case you can make for Boris Johnson's foreign secretaryship being a success.
No, that it was an absolute disaster. I mean, at best, you could say that 90% of the time he did no damage. But the problem is, the 10% of the time, he did massive amounts of damage.
There were some countries he apparently didn't make racial stereotypes about, but we're not sure who they were.
What is he? Starts quoting the road to Mandalay.
Yeah.
In the middle of, like, yeah, it's just like, oh.
Well, saying about, apparently saying about Leo Varadkar, the Irish tie sect, aren't they all called, he's the only one who isn't called Murphy or something. Whereas instead, the Boris Johnson pitch, as I think I mentioned when we did the podcast with David Barker, it's very much focused on his record as Mayor of London, which again ignores all the rubbish stuff like the Garden Bridge stuff, the water cannons.
His ridiculous idea about building a bloody airport on the Thames Estuary.
Yeah.
Just his infrastructure fetish, basically, which never seems to work out. He did it again recently. He started talking about building a bridge between Northern Ireland and Scotland for no apparent reason.
Indeed, it's with Johnson, it's all about the appearance rather than the reality of achievement. And the appearance is, I won a Labour city when the Tories were 10 or 15 points behind in the polls, and I can do it again now, and I can defeat Jeremy Corbyn. And all you have to do to resolve Brexit is have this can-do positive approach. That's all. You don't need to know about paragraph 5B of GATT or 5C. You just need to have a positive outlook. And it's interesting because a lot of those people in the Foreign Office, like Alastair Burt, Alan Duncan, who resigned yesterday, they didn't vote for him at all. But a lot of Tories who were worried, they are worried, I think, about Johnson's premiership, but I think have essentially voted for him because they think he'll win elections, based on that rhetoric, and I think that's probably quite mistaken, actually.
Yeah, I think it is as well. When you look at, like, Boris Johnson is more popular than Jeremy Corbyn. That's not that difficult to do, though, at the moment. Let's be honest here. So,
how dare you? I think they don't know is just such a formidable opponent that know what we all bow down.
This is true. Don't know is clearly the superior candidate in all circumstances currently. Johnson could be in a position where he can maybe beat Jeremy Corbyn. But equally, we've got a situation now with Corbyn and with Corbyn and Boris Johnson where it might just be that actually the only person the other person could potentially lose to is the other one. Like, any other Labour leader probably trounces Johnson. But at the same time, any other Tory leader probably trounces Corbyn. We've got this situation where we've got almost basically having to lean on, going to end up leaning on each other to actually stay stable, because any change, one of them crumbles.
I now have a new fantasy game, which is, can we just run general elections with equally different Labour and Tory leaderships? Like, I think the one where Marc Francois faces off against Richard Bergen is going to be a classic. Right, we've got tons of other stuff we could talk about because it's been weeks since you came here, and the scene when Steve first came into the bunker, it was like the scene when Lassie came home, to be honest. Leaping lovingly into arms. I've turned into Boris Johnson already, apparently.
You really have. Like, I am not a dog.
No, I was very... very drunk. But we will have a podcast out on Sunday about climate change in 2019. We're going to do silly season ones soon on the Labour Party, on the Lib Dems.
That's not to say either of those are silly, but they are going to be during silly season.
So
don't have a go at us, Mark. We're not saying the Lib Dems are silly.
No, we're... No, we'll have lots of things to say about Lib Dems, no, don't you worry. For now, our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. James Cram designed our logo. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter, at James Cram. And my Twitter handle is at Paperback Rioter.
And mine is at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting, especially if you're Philip Hammond.